Bring to order the meeting of the Public Safety Policy, Crime Prevention Policy and Finance, I should say. And we'll start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Hertas.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Rosenthal. Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Schoen. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Winkler. And Representative Zerwas.
Here.
All right, we've got a quorum. Now we'll, somebody wants to move the minutes of February 25th?
So moved.
All right. Representative Considine moves the minutes of February 25th. You know what, without any additions or corrections, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. What we'll do today is start out. We have several bills. I'm going to start out with my bill, House File 783.
Representative Cornish, you wish to move your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 783 be recommended to pass and referred to the Health and Human Services Reform. Ready?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, what House File 783 does is gives an enhanced penalty for anybody that assaults a direct care worker at the St. Peter Hospital. And maybe I just could ask Ms. Perius, it would be include any state hospital like Anoka too?
Mr. Chair and members, it would only cover Moose Lake and the Minnesota Security Hospital.
Okay. Moose Lake and Minnesota Security Hospital. And it would include the direct care workers with the mentally ill and dangerous is the point of the bill. Over the past 2 years, I've studied this closely and gotten a lot of data back from the Department of Human Services and from the union that that represents the workers at St. Peter Security Hospital. And you probably have heard this, but the union workers there, the workers at the St. Peter Hospital, have been assaulted at a high rate, probably one of the highest in the nation, and sometimes a score of them going to the emergency room in just a week or two. And actually, they're getting naturally kind of tired of this. And one of the reasons it's been given for not prosecuting this crime against these people is that the county attorneys don't think it's a serious enough charge, or that they're not taking it serious enough to have an enhanced penalty. That what this would do is bring it up from a misdemeanor to a felony. And we have a fiscal note that came back zero for the state agencies. They said that they didn't imagine that there would be a cost at this time, unless we mounted it up with all sorts of bills and including different groups of people. But at this time, it came back zero, and possibly a local impact, but it doesn't sound like there's anything to our state agencies. And at this time, if I could bring up my testifier from the employees down there, Mr.
Yes, sir.
You can go ahead and give your name and title.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ethan Vogel, a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. And unfortunately, none of our members could make it today, but they did ask that I testify on their behalf. I've been in touch with them and some of the members who work at the security hospital. And they support House File 783, as they believe it is a step in the right direction towards zero tolerance for violence in the workplace. and they think this will help deter violence and help keep the clients and themselves safe. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. But Mr. Chair and members, the reason that the bill is just that these aren't normal assaults. There has been some controversy, and there has been the question asked about the sense in charging these people, but and using the excuse that, which is a verified one in some cases, that they're mentally ill. However, many of these attacks are methodically planned out and carried out with intention, and not a lot to do with mentally ill. I guess I would argue the case that anybody that commits a serious crime could be argued to be mentally ill, and so I don't really consider that a valid claim in all sorts. And many times the union workers down there have told me that after the client assaults the worker, they'll stand back and put the hands up and say, time out, with just an episode, it's an excuse. And so what I'd like to do is at least charge these people, or be able to charge, bring it to the county attorney and let the county and attorney and courts decide that if this was planned or a case of mental deficiency. And at least right now, there is no consequence, it seems like, for these clients that assault the workers. In other words, if they know they're not going to get charged, which it doesn't sound like too many have been, what's the disincentive to not assault the worker? So with that, I'll entertain any questions that you have.
Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'm very supportive of the bill. I think it's long overdue. Having worked there and had my ribs broken and had a knee operation, half dozen pairs of glasses broken off my face, no one was ever charged in any of those instances. And is there some way that we can encourage the administration to follow through? At the time, given it's been a few years since I've been there, but at the time it was mostly the administration going, we're just not going to bother. Didn't even get to the county attorneys. So is there a way we can encourage them to follow through on this?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your question, Representative Considine. One of the problems is that the sex offender unit has a trained response team to come to incidences like this and intervene. However, the mentally ill and dangerous wing does not. It has what they call a floating utility team that whoever happens to be on duty, whether they're 4'8" or 290 pounds, doesn't matter. They just pick somebody who happens to be on duty, and it's not nearly trained to the professionalism that the SOP team. And that's something that we're working on there, and to get the buy-in that something is definitely wrong. And it is, and the problems of not being able to use restraints in certain instances, we're trying to encourage that. And they're on a tough spot between restraint and no restraint, naturally. But we had an instance where they didn't even restrain somebody in a van taken to a medical facility, and a fight broke out in the van, and one of the workers was injured. So there's a lot to be done in St. Peter and Anoka, and this is just a kind of a step, one of the steps to nibble off part of the picture.
Any other? Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering if staff could confirm, it's my understanding that employees at the federal medical facility already have a protection, I guess you'd call it, by having an attack or assault on them would be considered a felony. Is that a correct assessment of?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not exactly sure on that.
Representative Pop?
Mr. Chair, I do understand that for some federal employees, it's an automatic felony to assault them. And I was under the assumption that in a similar facility, a Minnesota resident that's employed by them in a similar facility, such as the Federal Medical Center, would already have this protection. And I think it's quite appropriate that the state step up and allow the Minnesota citizens working in their facility to have the same protection that the federal employed people would. So I support the intent and the execution of this bill.
Representative Constantine.
You read my mind. I don't. I believe it's also in state prisons too and jails that if you assault a officer, it's automatically a felony.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cornish. My question is regarding what you alluded to earlier about the issue of this is a condition of many of the individuals and their mental illness, and there's nothing in the bill that prohibits an individual to actually come forward and say, well, it was a condition of my mental illness that this occurred, and that's still a viable defense, even though we're changing the severity of the penalty here.
That's my understanding. Mr. Chair and members, that's my understanding, too. This is permissive. I mean, it doesn't restrict anything of a defense that one of the clients would use if they went to court with the whole competency issue or intent.
Is there anyone from the audience that wish to make any comments or statements? Okay, Representative Cornish, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I believe it's your intent that if something should happen, somebody is assaulted, it would be the clients there would still be under the trying to. If there is a mental issue, the courts would decide it's or the county attorney whether to pursue the charges, and with the same stipulations right now in any criminal case with them. Mentally handicapped person or anything like that?
That's correct.
Do you wish to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 783 be recommended to pass and move on to be referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed.
Thank you, members. Next, we have Representative Hertaus and House File 969. Representative Hertaus, are you ready to proceed? You can move your own bill since you're on the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. I would like to move House File 969 to be referred to the General Register. And okay. Before we get started on that, I have an A1 amendment late yesterday afternoon. After Commissioner's Department had a visit with me, they recommended a minor technical change in the language. We did not meet the 24-hour rule, so I would ask the members to waive the 24-hour rule and entertain the A1 amendment to amend the bill the way I would like it.
Representative Hillstrom, you up with that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is the or designee language.
Yes.
Is that correct? Mr. Chair, as long as you're going to take testimony from the department, I'd like to ask them some questions. I don't have a problem with the 24-hour rule.
Okay. Thank you. And when we get to, you want to present the bill first, and we'll get to question about the amendment?
Certainly.
All right. We've got to, you offer the amendment first here. Do you offer the amendment then?
Yes, I did.
Mr. Chair,
you don't have the amendment in the packet, so why don't you explain the amendment, Representative Hertaus? Oh,
thank you very much, Mr. Chair. On line 1.13, you will notice that it says agent must directly supervise the offender until electronic surveillance is activated. After the word agent, we would like to insert comma or the agent's designee.
Okay, does everybody understand the amendment? Would you like to question it now or wait till they present the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to question that language before you actually adopt it.
Okay.
So, because I might want to tweak it. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus, I'm pretty sure you're going to want someone from Corrections to help answer this question. But I want to know who that designee can be. For example, it's one thing if you want to designate local law enforcement or someone from a county jail or someone from a local community corrections. However, Representative Hertaus, I wouldn't want them to be able to designate someone else, not in law enforcement.
Okay. Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. As Department of Justice conferred with me yesterday, they pointed out a circumstance in which we're maybe in transition from incarceration to a halfway house or to house arrest where the intensive supervision of electronic monitoring would be employed, that the possibility might exist where maybe the landline doesn't work or that there's some glitch with the equipment where they can't leave them. And so in that circumstance, they wanted to be able to transfer that individual into the custody of the supervising agent at a halfway house or also to maybe transport him to the local county jail rather than back to prison. So that was my understanding of why they were asking for that additional language, and I'll have Department of Justice come down and answer that question as well.
Representative Hillstrom, you want to know who does it right now and who would be doing it under this scenario?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and again, if the goal is to make certain that before they're left, they have the electronic monitoring device on them, by allowing the halfway house to have possession of them, you're actually undoing the whole purpose of the bill, Mr. Chair. And so that's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay. Go ahead, sir. In your name and title.
Mr. Chair, I'm Ron Solhay, Deputy Commissioner at Department of Corrections for the Community Services Division. If I can provide some clarification of this, oftentimes offenders who are on intensive supervised release are being released to transitional housing in a halfway house that is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If for some reason that electronic monitoring was not working, and that's typically not the case, in a halfway house, we would have staff that are already there supervising these offenders when the agent is not present. So it wouldn't be any added staff to do this job. Also, in the rural areas where on occasion we do run into technical difficulties with the equipment, we would transport that individual to a local county jail on an A&D, as we would not have the resources to have the agent sit with the offender for an extended period of time. Certainly, we would try to resolve the monitoring issue if we could, but we would not have the number of agents that we'd need to have somebody sit with that individual, say, for a 24-hour period of time. So we would have to bring them to the local jail to place them in custody until we could resolve the monitoring issue. It's also important to note that the monitoring isn't activated until you're at the residence. It's not something that we can hook them up to in prison prior to release and have it activated. We have to activate it at the residence.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could you please be specific? The designees, are they state employees? Are they private contractors? Are they just halfway houses that might be any halfway house staffed by someone without law enforcement type training? I'm just trying to get a sense of who these designees really are.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. The designees in rural Minnesota would typically be the county jail. That would be the only resource we would have. In the metro area, the designees would be halfway houses that we currently contract with, such as 180 Degrees, RS Eden, that are providing transitional housing to offenders on intensive supervised release. So it would be utilizing an existing resource.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the designee, is there any period of time that they can be supervised by the designee and still comply with this statute? So, for example, if you need 24 hours and they're going to be supervised by RS Eden or one of those, that's not maybe necessarily unreasonable. But if it's going to be 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks, you've really just undone the purpose of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that wouldn't be our intention. Our intention would be to allow the agents to be able to do their job supervising offenders. They have essentially maxed caseloads, and they're required to remain in contact with these offenders four times a week, so we would not have the resources to keep an agent at a residence, say, for even 24 hours. It would hamper our ability to supervise the other offenders that are on intensive supervised release. So again, it would be a fairly rare circumstance in a halfway house setting. This is really more toward in a rural area where the only option we would have would be to bring them to the county jail to house them there while we're getting the monitoring issue resolved.
No.
Okay. Representative Hertaus. Oh, Representative Ward. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is this about this amendment?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
I'm concerned about how often this, just how big a problem is this. So how often does it happen that there are delays? And you said, I don't know, how long that would be? And would there, I mean, how do we resolve that? So do we need more staff to be sure that we can implement this in a more timely fashion? What's the problem?
Go ahead, sir.
Representative Cornish, Representative Ward. It happens infrequently. I would say in the metro area it rarely happens because phone lines and service providers are readily available. It's when you get to a more rural area, as example, out in the country, say in Roseau County or in Couchiching County, where we may have difficulty making a connection. And I don't have statistics on how frequently that happens. It does happen. This is electronic equipment. This equipment is really just an extension of the agent's ability to supervise offenders in the community. So it enhances their ability to supervise. But it is like any piece of technology. Sometimes there are problems with it. So in this case, this would be offenders on intensive supervised release, on the phase one of supervised release. I can't give you an idea of exactly how many times that we've run into technical errors, but again, it does happen with the equipment. Overall, there are probably in the neighborhood of about 12 to 1,500 offenders released from prison each year on intensive supervised release. With that, somewhere between 30 and 50% of those are on electronic monitoring during phase one. So it gives you an idea of the volume of offenders overall.
Okay. Representative Hertaus, you have some testifiers.
Well, thank you. And members, I have with me today John and Julie Gleason, along with their son Stephen, and other friends and family are here. Mr. Gleason would like to testify in a moment on behalf of this legislation. Before I do so, I just want to mention that on a September evening in 2012 in St. Cloud, Colton Gleason died as the result of an unprovoked assault by an offender who was just released from prison. And you may recall back at that time that there were news stories about numerous people being assaulted in what were called sucker punches. Presumably some of this was gang initiation rituals by assailants. So with that, I would like to introduce John Gleason and tell you a little bit about their circumstance and what happened to their son.
Welcome, sir. And before you begin, we haven't adopted the A1 amendment yet. So was there any other questions on the A1 amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, and I'll begin, sir. Sorry about that.
Yes, my name is John Gleason, my wife Julie, my two boys here that are here are Justin and Stephen behind us, and daughter-in-law Marissa, and other family and friends that are here. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thanks for letting us have this opportunity to come and talk a little bit about our son. Like Jerry had mentioned, our son was attacked, senseless attack, on September 21st, 2012. And you know, he should be here today. And had this law been in place, he would be. You know, it's absolutely senseless how a violent criminal can be released from custody, and the balance of his sentence is to be served under house arrest with monitoring bracelet, a GPS monitoring bracelet. But yet he's released from custody, and that bracelet's not put on till 5 days later. And 4 days prior to that getting put on, he had murdered my son, our son. And, you know, it's, you can question whether this is a common thing or not, but if it happens to one family, the destruction is just so great. You never recover from it. You just don't. You know, this particular offender, he was an extremely violent offender. He had already been, he had been virtually incarcerated for 5 assaults that he had committed with just in the last year. And he had been locked up. He had served his time being locked up, and the balance of his sentence was to be served at home. Even the county evaluators that were involved in his time that he was incarcerated said he was, deemed a danger to the public and the people around him. But yet he's still released without this monitoring bracelet put on him. Virtually just to be able to roam the streets, basically be on vacation until that bracelet gets put on. You know, the thing about that that's so difficult is that, you know, for those of you that have children and those of you that had children in college, you know, there has been trouble around campuses here in Minneapolis, around the U. I mean, everywhere there tends to be problems. Our son Colton was visiting friends at St. Cloud campus. And, you know, he did everything right that night. You know, he left in a group. He stayed in well-lit areas. He told people where he was leaving, where he was going. He did everything right. But yet that still wasn't enough. And you think about this. This could be your child. I mean, it's one of those situations where he was with 2 girls. He was walking home. It was early on a Thursday night. You know, and he was walking home, 9 o'clock. But there was a car cruising around that very same night. 6 people in that car. 3 of them part of an actual known gang in St. Cloud. I mean, the St. Paul police knew of this person very well and the gang that he belonged to. And they were out looking just to cruise around and look for trouble, because the perpetrator in this particular case, you know, is supposed to be under house monitored arrest. Our son is walking down an alleyway, which is wide. When you hear alley, you get nervous. It's well lit and wide. He's walking down that alleyway when this car came and swerved at him and the girls. Came so close it brushed up against him. Car stopped. 5 people got out. Our son was surrounded by 3 of them. He told the girls to turn and just keep walking and move away. He thought he had the entire situation diffused. Everything seemed to calm down. This is from witnesses. And believe it or not, one of the witnesses from the car. And as it looked like it was going to be over and the guys were going to walk away and everything was going to be fine, somebody hit him from the side. And and that blow caused him to fall down and hit his head so hard it cracked his skull in 3 places. And he died of severe brain trauma. You know, and it's just, again, it's completely senseless, you know, and our family shouldn't have to be here today, but Colton should be. But since he's not, we have to do something. We can't let this happen to another family and destroy another family. It's just, it's senseless. And it's such a simple thing for us to do. Just make people accountable. Before someone's released, all the conditions of that are met. You know, I ask myself all the time, what could we do different? And I think about the morning when we said goodbye to our son, Colton. That very same day, both Julie and I gave him a hug and said, we'll see you tomorrow. We're going to be mountain biking. And, you know, we've all said we love you, gave him a hug, and I keep thinking, if I were just hung on a second longer, he might be here today. And you always play that kind of stuff back in your mind, what could I have done differently? And this is actually something that we all could do. This is something that we actually have control of. And, you know, to help another family, I look at it this way. Our son Colton paid the ultimate price that night. You know, he gave his life protecting other people. And, you know, he'll always be remembered as a precious son, brother, cousin, friend, and to all of those that knew him, a hero. And I just ask that we get this law moved forward. I just can't stand the thought this could happen and destroy another family.
Sir, would your wife like to testify, or?
I think the only thing that I have to say is when I found out that this person was released just a day before he killed our son, and he was supposed to be under house arrest with a monitoring bracelet. I just couldn't understand how he actually got out of jail without that bracelet on. And he was just running around, and the first thing he did was go out and find someone to kill. And I just can't, I just hope that you pass this through so that this doesn't happen. Because we've been going through 2 years of hell.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Sir, is there anybody, friends or family here with you you'd like to introduce, or?
So my son Stephen, my son Justin, daughter-in-law Marissa, these are aunts, cousins, sister.
Grandma.
Well, good to have you here. Thanks for your testimony. I would advise if you could all come back for the next appearance. Where's the phone register? Oh, well, maybe when you will be able to sit up and watch it pass in the balcony at the house, if it gets there with favorable results. Representative Hertaus, anybody else that you would like to testify?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And just the closing comments that I wanted to make about this is just in these certain circumstances when offenders are released from incarceration, we find that maybe because we have, as a matter of policy rather than law, implementation of putting in these electronic monitoring systems, that we make it a seamless transition and move from policy to law and provide every circumstance in which we can assure that this transition happens in a seamless way and will provide the protections of not allowing offenders to be roaming the streets freely. And with that, I would make my motion again.
We haven't taken questions.
Okay. Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I have a couple of questions for the department. I want to discuss phase one, and then I want to talk about access in the rural areas. If they would just
have the whoever would like to come down again. Could you ask your question?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, can you give us just a little bit of insight what phase one is in their release? Is that technically they could still be in custody instead of phase one, correct? I mean, they could serve custody all the way through in custody versus being on intensive supervised release?
Good question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, when an offender reaches their two-thirds time in custody, they are released on supervised release. We're talking about prison offenders here, that this statute relates to intensive supervised release. This does not relate to probation. Probation, in this case, this offender was on probation at the local county level. So this statute relates specifically to intensive supervised release, so offenders releasing from prison. Offenders that meet the criteria for ISR or intensive supervised release are placed on phase one. ISR is a year-long supervision period. There are four phases for intensive supervised release. The first phase is 4 months, and during that phase, often offenders are placed on electronic monitoring.
Mr. Chair, and if staff in your direction can answer this, so are we not addressing the issue at the county level then with this statute? Are we only, did I just hear you say we're only addressing someone that comes out of a Department of Corrections facility, but not necessarily, so Colton wouldn't have been protected by this law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, this only applies to offenders releasing from prison, not on county probation.
Okay.
So this would not have applied in this case, but this electronic monitoring is a part of the process of intensive supervision as well.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the second question I have is, do we, if it's the Department of Corrections Do we send people out to the home to make sure the equipment works and that the communication works before they're released currently? I mean, do we send an agent out and go meet with the family and say, Jerry's going to live here, and so we're going to make sure that the monitoring equipment actually works before we open the door and send them out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, yes, we do. In all cases, with offenders releasing from prison on intensive supervised release, the agent has to approve the residence. They transport the offender to the residence, or our transport unit from the prisons transport the offender to the residence. At that point in time, the electronic monitoring is hooked up. If it's not activated or there's a technical problem, that's where this would come in, where we would utilize a jail or a halfway house potentially under this bill.
Mr. Chair, I'm a co-author with Representative Hertas, and I know he was raising his hand. I'd like him to address the county issue if you can.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schoen, I had not intended for that to be any loophole in this, and when I met with corrections yesterday, he pointed out what he deemed the term commissioner to relate to just those that are in the state penitentiary. So with that, it is my full intention to make that fix before it would become law. We need to add another amendment if we can get this to the House floor. So it's kind of a work in process, but it was not at all my intention to allow those who are incarcerated at the county level and released on probation to allow 5 days vacation before this equipment gets put on. And really, when you think about the logistics of what is known, everybody knows what the release date is. So it's just a matter of being well organized in terms of knowing that the private contractors that provide this equipment, sometimes there's a landline that needs to be installed at a place of house arrest, the individual's home. Make sure that equipment is functional is the whole purpose of giving advance notice by the offender or the offender's family, making sure that that equipment is there. Otherwise, he doesn't get out of jail. That's what the intent of this is. And we'll make those technical fixes between now and when it gets to the floor.
Representative Schoen.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas, I'm with you. Do you have any idea how that's going to look? I mean, because I can only imagine our counties coming to either tell us they didn't know or they didn't that whatever the costs are going to be to them, and that could maybe change things. I think we should do it. I'm just wondering how this looks, Mr. Chair, going if we're going to do it before we get to the floor without having a little more review of that particular piece. And again, I'm very supportive. I just, as far as process goes, it seems it might be problematic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen.
Representative Herhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, I mean, Representative Herhoff, just a second. We, to make the changes we need to is going to require a substantive amendment, and I don't know if we can do it in this time. We'd have no more stops between here and the floor. So what are you suggesting, that we hold it over, fix it, and then send it to the floor?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Ms. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we all think that it should include counties and that we really want to make sure we get it right. And so I also think that if we're going to include counties, they may want to have something to say about the language. So, Mr. Chair, I think that we should hold it over. We should actually fix it, find out if it's going to cost any money, and then pay for it if we need to. So, Mr. Chair, that would be my suggestion, that we actually I have some additional questions from the department now that I know that it only includes level ones from prison, because I bet they have a bunch of folks that are released on electronic home monitoring that aren't in the ISR program, and I don't know what number that is. And then I don't have any idea how many are released from the county that are put on electronic home monitoring. And so I think we should maybe get the data and do it right, Mr. Chair.
Do we have you want to question somebody from the
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask the Department of Corrections how many offenders they have that are released on electronic home monitoring that are not in ISR, and then I would assume that the Sheriff's Association was going to want to testify at some point, but probably when we have language to fix it.
Okay. Did you got the question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't have that number with me currently, but we will get you that information as far as, and just to be sure I have it correct, you would like to know the number that we are releasing from prison that are placed on electronic monitoring that are not on ISR supervision. And we will also look at the number that we are releasing on ISR supervision that are placed on electronic monitoring as well. We'll get you both of those numbers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think we should have a clear picture of the number of folks we're really talking about here and make sure that we have the language to reflect those folks.
Representative Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that since I started us down this path of to Colton's family, I hope you understand that the questions we're asking are because we want to make sure that that is fixed so that someone in your similar circumstance is protected as well, too. And so sometimes it takes an extra day or so to make that happen, but we're going to do it and do it right. And I don't know how many people come through these doors and sit at that table and say, I wish I had one more second or one more day, and we feel your pain, too. Obviously not to your same level, but that's what we're here to deal with, and we're going to do it right.
And since we're in your primary jurisdiction here, it wouldn't be a good idea to let something out with the substantive changes that we'd like to make and clarify. But I think the people are in favor of the bill, but we need to do some work on it. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertzog, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. And with the police and family, I understand your loss. We need to get this right. As far as I'm concerned, anybody that's released from county, state, any corrections facility that's supposed to be on electronic monitoring should not be unsupervised without that electronic monitoring working. That's part of their condition of release. So we need to make sure we get this right to make sure that that is done, that if they are going to be released, electronic monitoring is working properly.
Representative Hertos.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, thank you, and I'm going to take that advice and also request that we lay this over. We will work together to get this done. There's broad bipartisan support. More than 15 members have signed on to this bill. I wanted to point out that the fiscal note at the state level was zero. Transportation of that individual to house arrest is currently done by DOJ. They're currently doing that. We expect the same thing to happen at the county level, and want to make sure that all the equipment is functional and operational and that there isn't any gaps in the coverage that's supposed to be carried out as part of the sentence. So thank you for identifying that problem. I was aware of it as we came to the meeting, but only became aware yesterday. And so we need to fix that. So I'll ask that this be laid over and we get it fixed.
We've got to get to a public testimony here. Did anybody come from the public? We probably won't take a lot of testimony when we bring this up again. Representative Hertos will work with Representative Hillstrom and Schoen and others to get the bill in the proper order so there aren't any more questions. But anybody come to testify on the bill today? Okay, thank you very much, Representative Hertos, and with that, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion, and then we'll formally bring it back up again, possibly send it on its own way rather than put it in the omnibus bill. So we will lay the bill over. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Now we've got Representative Howe with House File 323. Representative Howe, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 323 to be passed and referred to the Committee on Jobs and Growth.
Okay, Representative Howe, sounds good. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I'd like to move the DE-1-2 amendment, the Delete All Amendment.
Okay, that's in our packet. Okay, the DE-1-2. All right, Representative Howe moves his DE-1-2 amendment. And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what this bill does is it does two things. One, it gives the cities the authority to work with the relief associations and withhold the relief association dues from the firefighters, the membership dues. The next thing it does is it allows the cities and the firefighters out there, the volunteers and the volunteer ambulance services, to actually coordinate to authorize by statute what they're currently doing. Currently, the statute requires them to pay firefighters and these ambulance people at least every 31 days. I spent 27 years in the fire service, and 19 of those on a volunteer department. We got paid once a year, because, and usually those payments to those volunteer fire departments, a lot of times were between $1,000 and $4,000. So to make them pay those payments every 31 days would cost us more in paperwork than it would be to do it. So this, what this does then, if we authorize this by statute, cleans it up so when the state auditor, when these cities get audited by the auditor, that they don't get gigged for not complying with this law. So, Mr. Chair, I'd now like to leave this to my testifiers.
Go ahead and introduce yourself, your name and title. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Kushner. I'm here with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I work in the HR department. And I actually think Representative Howe did a great job of explaining the part of the bill that I'm here to testify on, which is exactly that. In some cases, volunteer firefighter and ambulance payrolls are so small, to do it every 2 weeks or monthly is just results in very, very small paychecks. And I'm told by our own finance department at the league that every time they issue a check for anything, it probably costs them $20 to $30. So this is just more efficient. My understanding is the firefighters like it, everybody's happy, and there's a provision in the bill that says both parties have to agree. So I think it does what we need it to do.
Okay. Sir, did you want to testify?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Ganfield. I'm a retired firefighter with Apple Valley Fire Department. I had 22 years in there, and current president of the Apple Valley Firefighters Relief Association. I have more than 30 years on as a member of that board. As Representative Powell stated, times have changed, essentially. We're in the 21st century. Some of these things, though, there's over 700 fire relief associations in the state. Some pay dues, some don't. Typically, it was an annual payment. This just simplifies the process. I'm here in support of this bill, that it clarifies things. It just makes it simpler for our relief.
Mr. Chair, I also do know the Fire Chiefs Association and the Fire Department Association also supports the bill. So with that, if there's any questions.
Have you found any opposition?
No.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howe, I noticed that first responders aren't listed here, and I know that at least one or more of those groups are paid annually. So I'm wondering, is there already something like this for them, or is this just something that wasn't was an oversight in drafting this bill?
Representative Hall.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe that you're talking about rescue squads. If that's, I would assume that we meant to probably, and I'm not quite sure. I'd have to look at see what's defined in that section 424A, but I'm not quite sure. Maybe staff could help us with that to see if they're included, if the rescue squads are in that definition or not. I'm not sure.
Mr. Deeble, do you have any idea?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not familiar with that statute. Our analyst who covers this area is here. Like an answer. Mr. Weeks.
It might be an oversight. They may not be included.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. And basically, with some of the smaller towns, which bundled up with townships around them, they often will have a first responders squad, and they will cover the medical and the non-fire auto accidents, etc. Suicides. My wife delivered a baby in one instance. And so they, you know, frankly, are not an unusual entity in this state. They perform similar where you don't couple the medical into the fire department. They've got vehicles, squads, training, you know, et cetera. And I think it would be appropriate if they aren't already covered to have it taken care of here just for completeness and thoroughness.
Representative Howe, I don't know if we could do that in our committee. It'd be a substantive amendment. And if you wanted to work on that definition and who is included between now and the Jobs Committee, that would be great. And
Mr. Chair, if Representative Quam would be amenable to that, I would take that, and we would probably make another amendment when we get the jobs and include those first responder and rescue squads into the bill.
Okay, just be careful if we do that, that it make sure it check the fiscal note first, or if there's no opposition, because right now everything's smooth sailing. If we add more people to it, it could change things. So, what? Mr. Weeks, is you in the room here? Did you want to comment on anything? Anything needs clarification here? You're the analyst from the jobs.
Mr. Chair, members, my understanding, as currently drafted, that the bill does not include first responder rescue squads. I'm not sure if they are included under the definition of volunteer ambulance attendants, which are included, but I can check into it and get back to the committee.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else have any questions? How about the public? Any questions from the public? Seeing no further questions, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd renew my motion to have this passed and re-referred to Jobs and Growth.
Okay. You've heard the motion re-referred to Jobs and Growth for House File 323. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carried. Thank you, Representative Howe, and the testifiers. Representative Schoenhoff, file 1077.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Is this going in the omnibus bill, Chair Cornish, or what's the plan? I don't even know where it's going.
Yeah, we're going to
lay it over.
Lay it over. You can make the motion to lay it over if you wish.
I'll make said motion.
Okay, Representative Schoenhoff moves this bill to be laid over for possible inclusion. Go ahead, Representative Schoenhoff.
Mr. Chair and members, this is the probably the most exciting piece of legislation you'll see before this committee this year. This is the Department of Public Safety Technical Correction Bill. So quickly, I'll just put out in Section 1, this is into Chapter 212 from the 2014 session. And Section 1 removes references to radio receiving sets. Well, we don't even have those anymore. Section 2 also refers to repealing some language like broadcasting station and public safety answering points that are mentioned in referencing sections of law that were actually repealed, so they're no longer needed. Sections 3 and 4 remove references to a repealed section and replace it with the existing authority to the secure network operated by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Section 5 is in response. That extra words are, if you're curious about Section 5, there were folks at the BCA lab that were actually in the State Patrol retirement system. They're not current employees. They're currently retired. But we need to make sure that they actually are drawing from and continue to remain in the retirement plan that they left service in or with. Section 6, 7, and 8, again, we're removing references to sections that were repealed relating to prohibition of an employer retaliating against a crime victim. And then Section 9 repeals language requiring telegraph and telephone companies to give priority messages or calls directed to broadcasting stations.
So we need to make sure that since we, I'm not sure, we probably got rid of the last telegraph maybe last year, who knows, but we don't need them anymore. So if there's any questions, I've got the foremost expert in the entire country sitting next to me, and she'll gladly answer them, but if people are comfortable, this is the a reviser's technical correction issue.
Okay, members, any questions? Representative Schoen, any comment from the public on this highly technical bill? All right. Representative Schoen, seeing no questions and no public testimony, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, please.
Okay, Representative Schoen moves that the bill be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. And Representative Schoen, untested sexual assault kits accounted for in report required, House File 1140.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House File 1140 before the committee to be referred to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Schoen.
Also would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Schoen would like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in form that he would like it. Any questions or objections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. A1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I did have one minor thing I wanted to ask Ms. Tockett-Holsey. We didn't touch base, but did this correct the issue that you brought up to me? Some minor wording change that needed to be that we could probably take care of.
It was about a technical thing. Line 1.14 on the amendment, I had asked if you wanted to include the word rape after each and also after two to clarify that they were rape kits, where because you had clarified it earlier.
And Mr. Chair, I think that that's a good idea if you're okay with just those two changes to make sure that it's consistent throughout the bill.
Could one of our researchers read the amendment as you understand it?
Or if it even matters, Mr. Diebel.
Or if it what?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Diebel, if those changes are significant enough to be necessary.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the statutes is only referring to kit in one context of a rape kit. So I don't know that it would be confused with other kits because it's a self-contained statute. So although it, I don't think it makes a difference if it's included or not included.
Okay. So if we include it, how would it read?
Mr. Chair and members, you'd be amending the amendment of the A1 amendment on line 1.14. After the before the first kit, you'd insert the word rape, and before the actually insert untested rape kit, and then before the second, or actually the word kits, further down on line 1.14, you'd put untested rape kits.
And having done that, now I'll leave it up to you whether you would like the amendment added or not. Do you have another counterpart in the Senate that you want to, would this complicate things, or would you rather just leave it the way it is?
I think that they can fix that same. I don't think this has been heard yet in the Senate. We're first, so why don't we go ahead and make that so that we're consistent. If the committee is good with that, I think it's worthwhile. And
Representative Johnson on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think if I remember right, these are not called rape kits, they're sexual assault kits. I think we need to get the proper term because in Minnesota we have sexual assault in our statutes, not rape.
What, Representative Schoen, any reply to that?
We can call it, I mean, yeah, you'll see some of the handouts that refer to it as sexual assault exam kit, and we can...
I see in the definition...
And so, I mean, we've already got the definition on 1.10 is that the definition of rape kit actually is defined as means of sexual assault examination kit. And probably some of that is just for generalized understanding if the average person is reading it. So.
Would that be okay, Representative Jones?
But, I mean, you maybe want to ask the Honorable Jeff Diebel if we have any issues.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, I was searching my file on this to see, I believe the term rape kit is used elsewhere in statute, but I'm not finding it in my file. I'd have to spend a little time. So I don't think it's unprecedented to use the term. Obviously, if it's the will of the committee to refer to them as sexual assault.
Mr. Chair, I believe our lab folks from the BCA may be here too. If it gets them worried, then we can ask them to come down and comment on it. But no, well, come on down.
Just a second, Mr. Diebel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I did find it now. It's in 609, section 609.35, it costs of a medical examination. There is references. These costs include but are not limited to full costs of the rape kit examination. And so there are current references, and I would just, if you're going to go to the direction of changing all of them, you probably would need to amend the other statutes or to make it consistent.
That's probably why we did it in the first place.
Yeah, I see. Right. No big need. Representative Plum, did you have anything? Or otherwise, we'll just leave it alone. Now, the amendment to the amendment you've offered.
Yes.
Okay.
Are you good with that, Mr. Chair?
I'm good. Amendment to the amendment, as it was read off, everybody understand? If so, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we're good to go as far as
now. All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intent of House File 1140 comes from a nationwide project. It's called the Rape Kit Action Project. And in several other states, folks are finding out that there are sexual assault exam kits that are sitting on shelves in law enforcement agencies or others that are connected to a reported crime that haven't been tested. In Minnesota, we actually don't charge each individual agency for the testing of those kits to procure any DNA samples. And so there is no cost to each individual agency, and we don't, so therefore we shouldn't have any reason that anybody would be holding these tests for fear of cost. We actually think that in Minnesota we're probably leading by example and have a really good track record of making sure that these are tested. I inquired within my own county, and I haven't found any agency that has any sitting on the shelf. But we want to make sure that they aren't. So this particular bill is just going to make sure that we're requesting a report from law enforcement agencies around the state. Do you have any of these kits on your shelf, and are they untested? And if they are, we kind of want to know why. And then we can determine, is there an action that we need to do to make sure that we mandate it or not? Quite frankly, there are many scenarios, and one of the scenarios you might hear about is a victim can self-report to a hospital, and they don't have to report it to the police. This is not about that particular scenario. If a victim goes in and does not want it reported to the police, this kit will not be tested because they don't have the consent to send it in to be tested in the first place. So that's their right, and we're not going to infringe upon that. Again, this is when we look back in other states. Colorado did a test. They had 2,200 in untested kits. Illinois, 4,000. Texas, 20,000. Phoenix, Arizona alone, 3,000. Cleveland, Ohio, 4,000. Detroit, 11,000. Memphis, 12,000. Several other states have passed this legislation, including Hawaii, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Tennessee, Virginia, that do the accounting, and that Colorado, Illinois, Michigan, and Texas have actually mandated the accounting and the testing. So at that point, it's pretty straightforward. The average cost of these kit or the testing is about $1,000 at the BCA. And again, we recognize that at a state level that is such a big deal, we pay for that out of the Department of Public Safety budget. So we don't want that to be a problem for a small agency. And Chair Cornish, when you were the chief down in I can't remember, Good Thunder or wherever,
Lake Crystal.
Lake Crystal, there you go. You know, $1,000, if you had to have three or four of them in a year, that could be a significant expense. We've long ago removed the fear of expense for local agencies on this testing process. So we just need to make sure it's actually getting done. And I think that this particular bill brings that forward and brings attention to the issue of, I think it's going to show that Minnesota's been doing a pretty good job, but we're also going to make sure that agencies know that we expect you to get this tested and there's no reason to hold back. Because if that was our daughter or my daughter and I found out somebody was holding back on that for no reason, I'd be pretty upset. So with that, I do have some folks that are in the crowd that are willing to answer any questions or discuss this about how it came along. And again, I want to clarify, we're not in this bill going to mandate that folks get tested. We want to count and know, is there actually a problem? And that's what we're trying to get to the bottom of. Because nationwide, there has been issues, and we just want to make sure that we don't have that issue in Minnesota.
Okay, members, any questions, or does anybody here wish to hear additional testimony for clarification? We have a couple of testifiers here. James Hager and Emma Greenman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Hager, and I'm here as a private citizen but working as a volunteer with a Rape Kit Action Project. I just wanted to provide a little bit of background on the bill in addition to what Representative Schoen discussed. You know, the Rape Kit Action Project is a national organization working on audit and inventory bills like this across the country. They are working along with other organizations as part of the National Center for Victims of Crime. I just wanted to add a little bit of information. In addition to what Representative Schoen mentioned, we had a report just last week from the city of Houston, Texas. They've now tested 6,600 previously untested kits. Of that, they were able to match 850 of those, the DNA found in 850 of those kits, to people already in their state's criminal database and file 29 new charges from those kits. As Representative Schoen said, we don't have a full picture of where things stand in Minnesota, and that's why we feel this bill is so important. We do know that according to information provided to the BCA and research that we've done, that at least four cities in Minnesota do have some backlog ranging from 30 to 300 untested kits. I think we're also likely to hear from the Sheriff's Association today. They've done a survey of their sheriff's offices, and I believe they found little to no kits there, so that's, I think, a good sign that Minnesota's problem is not as large as those in other states. That said, you know, the benefit of the bill is that we get a full, comprehensive apples-to-apples report, including all sheriff's offices, all police departments, and we really know where we stand in Minnesota as it relates to untested kits. That will allow us to start a conversation about what, if anything, we need to do about it. I also just wanted to note that we've been working with the BCA and with MnCASA, and the language you saw in the author's amendment reflects their concerns and suggested language that they have, and so we believe that the bill is going to be easy for the department to work with. We've also heard from the BCA that they'll be able to absorb any costs of doing the report. Finally, I just close by saying that I'm volunteering to help out on this bill for three reasons. First, the little evidence that we know in Minnesota shows us that there are some untested kits here in the state, and the evidence from other states shows us that testing those kits could lead us to bringing up charges. Second, to paraphrase from the letter you have in front of you from MCCL, this bill would be an important step in showing victims that our community is taking the crimes they suffered seriously. And finally, I think it is an important sign to our citizens that government works. If somebody is attacked and they spend the up to 4 hours it takes to have evidence literally picked and swapped off their body, and they ask law enforcement to test that evidence and to try to bring charges, I think it is, you know, just fair and reasonable and common sense that we as a state would support them and do what we can to bring the victims some comfort and bring the the perpetrator to justice. This bill will help us identify the scope of our problem here in Minnesota, and I hope it can be the start of a conversation about what to do with it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and happy to take any questions.
Okay. Questions so far? The other testifier? Or Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, you mentioned that you checked with the sheriff's office and throughout a number of them, they have found none, which is great. Minnesota, there is no charge for testing these kits. The BCA takes care of that, or the state takes care of the testing of the kits. But if I heard you correctly, you mentioned that you found three or four cities that had these kits. For me, I would like to have all those police chiefs sitting here finding out why they haven't tested them. Because there's no cost to the city to have them tested. And I would love if you would provide me the names of those cities so we can look into it and why they haven't been put in.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, when you vote yes on this bill today and vote it off the floor, we're going to get a comprehensive report from every agency in the state, and then it's going to be public, and they're going to have to answer to why they didn't do it.
Okay. Do we do a testify, ma'am?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emma Greenman. I'm a civil litigator in private practice, a former public defender, and while my professional experience informs my opinion on this legislation, I'm here in my capacity as a private citizen. And I want to focus my testimony on three big reasons to pass this legislation. The victims of sexual assault, the equal and consistent administration of justice, and the power of the data. First and foremost, this bill is about victims of sexual assault. It's about ensuring that they have the evidence they need to seek justice in their individual cases, and that they trust that the system is working for them. Rape kits, as you all know, are a valuable tool that can help law enforcement identify a perpetrator, serve as evidence in a trial, or help identify serial offenders, as we've seen it done in other places where they've tested their backlogs of rape kits. And after the physical and emotional trauma of being raped, rape victims go through the emergency room and they spend hours being probed and swatted to collect and preserve that evidence, evidence that they believe will be used to bring their attackers to justice. This experience is no doubt hard and emotional, but it is essential. But that's only if the evidence in the rape kit is analyzed and tested and preserved. And you can imagine how disempowering it must feel after going through this experience to learn that your evidence of sexual assault is being shelved or stored and is not available in the criminal justice system. We can't let that happen in Minnesota. And to ensure that doesn't happen, we need to make sure that we know where, if there is a backlog of untested rape kits, and that bill will do this. Second, this bill is about the state's obligation to ensure equitable and consistent justice in a situation where victims too often receive inconsistent justice. We must commit ourselves as Minnesotans to working for every victim, no matter where they live, what department their evidence goes into, or what their story is. And that means showing victims that law enforcement and the gun enforcement and the government is doing everything they can to pursue justice. And frankly, it means collecting and analyzing the forensic data that may exonerate the wrongly accused or the wrongly convicted as well. This legislation is a common sense first step. Third, this bill is about having access to the data about how Minnesota's doing. As we heard before in previous testimony, this will help us understand if there is a problem and if we are doing all we can to ensure that sexual assault victims get the justice they deserve. We must account for every county and every police department and understand if rape kits are not being tested, why they're not being tested. First, this is a great first step where the legislature can take it and pass it and make sure that we have that useful and actionable data. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, ma'am. Members, questions? Any questions from the public or testimony? Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the Law and Policy Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We represent over 60 sexual assault advocacy programs throughout the state. First of all, I would like to thank Representative Schoen for his interest in improving the response to sexual assault in our state. We greatly appreciate that. And I wanted to let you know that we share this interest at MnCASA, and currently we are actually working on the Medical Forensic Exam Access Project. This is through a grant with the Office of Justice Programs at the Department of Public Safety. This project will be up at the end of this year. I just wanted to give you a heads up that there are a lot of issues with our forensic exam system that need to be addressed. We had some conversations earlier about costs. Sometimes costs actually do get to be a barrier. And so that's something we are looking at, and we'll be bringing probably some more legislation here in the future for you to talk about in the next session. In fact, what we've learned is Minnesota actually may be one of the most confusing states in the country when it comes to access to forensic exams, because we do it on a county-by-county basis, and so that most states have a centralized system in their state, and so it gets to be very difficult to know what each county or each hospital will do. As mentioned earlier, I think it's great that Minnesota doesn't seem to have the huge backlog problems that cities like Houston, Los Angeles, and Detroit do, but we still know that there may be some, and we appreciate the opportunity to find out if there is something that needs to be done. I also just wanted to state that I'm very pleased that Representative Schoen has agreed to include language in the bill about victim consent, and I just wanted to explain that a little bit more so that you know it. State law under Minnesota State Statute 609.35, which was referenced earlier with regard to the rape kit definition, it actually supports access to the sexual assault exam without a payment requirement to the victim, and also doesn't require the victim to report to law enforcement if they're not ready to do so. This actually is a requirement under the Federal Violence Against Women Act, and the state complies with that requirement in order to receive certain funding. As you can imagine, the real reason for this is that we want to make sure victims go and get health care when they're ready to do so, and then they can decide later whether or not they want to actually go and make a report. Finally, the one thing you may have heard about, and you may hear some more in additional testimony, is there are hospitals holding kits, and they are doing so because they haven't been turned over to law enforcement yet. Or the victim hasn't decided whether or not they want to move forward. You may also hear that there are some law enforcement agencies that are holding kits that are not ready for testing yet because the victim hasn't released them. And some of that has to come down to storage issues or agreements that's been made with a hospital or a local sexual assault response team. Again, those storage issues are something we're working to figure out. We would like to see more consistency across the state. And so if additional audits are done in the future, you might even get a better idea of what actually it looks like. But we know some language was added in the amendment to explain the reason why a kit has been counted or not been counted. And that might be the reason we are seeing is that a kit may be at a law enforcement agency, but it's not yet ready to be counted because the victim hasn't released it. So with that, I just want to say thank you very much for your consideration. Thank you again to Representative Schoen. And this is probably the tip of the iceberg of issues with forensic compliance, so you'll probably be seeing some more of us next year to talk further. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Executive Director. Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. I'll try to be concise and not reiterate the points that have already been made here today. Some of my comments will actually go towards and strengthening the representative's bill here. When we saw this bill, and I talked to James a week or two ago and said we'd be happy to participate in this because we've had ongoing discussions with the sexual assault advocates over this whole issue and how and what is the best way to address this. And you've enumerated a number of the things that we have on the agenda that we want to talk about here into the future. Having said that, I quickly on Friday sent out a quick survey just to, with the sheriffs to see what we have. I've got the results back, but all but 10 that have not gotten back to me, and I have a few on my pager that that I haven't looked at yet. They all come back with zero kits that are being held. We do have kits that are being held because the victim has not consent. And out of courtesy and everything, we have not sent those kits in. I think that's one of the large philosophical questions that have to be addressed. Should those kits be sent in? Should they be tested? One of the things that BCA will tell you is that they cannot be entered into the national database without the victim and information, so on and so forth. Maybe we should be starting a Minnesota database with kits that have not been tested. So while we're happy to go ahead and work with this, we're happy to work as law enforcement anyway to try to address this. This is a work product that we have talked about that we wanted to spend the next year working on, because we do think there are significant questions here about policy that we want to move forward in Minnesota. And I would just conclude by saying I think Minnesota's way ahead. I'm sure that we're not going to find hundreds of kits sitting in police departments in the state. But I do have concerns about the number of kits that are in hospitals that have not been given to law enforcement and we have no access to, because that is basically medical data that we should not really have. If we take custody of all those things, now we have medical data inside law enforcement agencies, we have biohazard things that we have to deal with. It's a quagmire that I think we want to address, find a good way of doing it, but it's a collaboration of the sexual assault victims group, the hospitals, law enforcement, and county attorneys who have the prosecution in these cases. Thank you.
Thank you, and lots of good information. We're just concerned with this bill today, and then the other issues we need to work on. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Sean, for clarifying that. That's what I wanted to point out, was the latter part of what Mr. Franklin brought up is a concern long-term, big picture, but that's not part of this bill.
Right, and we even talked about that in my office, yeah, about the hospital situation. Members, anybody have any questions so far? Is there anybody from the public? Is that it? I think we already called for Representative Schoen, any closing comments before you move your bill?
Mr. Chair, members, thanks for the time. I renew my motion to send House File 1140 to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Schoen moves his bill to the General Register. Without any questions, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Anything else? Okay, meeting adjourned.